direct from Fort Meade, Maryland, this is DinFos Live.
Hello and welcome to DinFos Live. I'm Major David J. Murphy, a DinFos instructor and your host for today's program. On this month's episode, we're talking all about public relations and how it intersects and aligns with public affairs. Joining us to discuss this topic is the owner and operator of Achilles PR and founder of the DLE agency, Mr. Doug Eldridge. Welcome to the program, Doug.
Thanks, Major. Thanks for having me.
Have a seat, please. Now, before we get to know you and what you do as a public relations specialist, of course, I want to let all of our audience know that if they're interested in asking questions of our guests, to please put those in the chat below, and we might just read them on the air. All right, well, let's go ahead and get on with the questions, Doug. First and foremost, can you tell me a little bit about your background and your history with regard to public relations?
Well, I have to say from the jump, Major, it's a pleasure to be here. And part of the reason is because it feels like I'm at home. I'm an Army brat. I grew up in a military family. My mom still has a needle point in the bathroom that says, home is where the Army sends you. My father was a Cobra pilot in Vietnam, transitioned from air cav to armor after the war, ultimately became a company commander in a tank battalion in then West Germany in the 70s. 10 years later, in the early mid 80s, I would join him and my mom, and I got to grow up in West Germany and went through a Checkpoint Charlie and the Brandenburg Gate and skied in Austria. And when my dad, they would go downrange for gunnery for 6 weeks at a time, the Grafenwehr, and we'd get to go visit them. And I got to ride in this new vehicle that the military was rolling out called the Humvee. It looked like a flat pizza box with wheels. It was hopefully going to mitigate the rolling issues with the Jeep. So I say that to say I grew up in an Army family, and military is and forever will be part of who I am, and in every way possible. Despite moving around a little bit growing up, I went to college and law school in Virginia. My father's buried in Arlington National Cemetery. My mom is president of the Gold Star Wives and serves as an Arlington lady. During college, I worked on Capitol Hill. And then during law school, I continued to work on Capitol Hill and later went to the Department of Justice. And as I left DOJ, I always knew what I wanted to do. Mind you, growing up, I was always a great athlete, or at least a good athlete. Mm-hmm. Football, baseball, basketball. I was an All-American in track. I ran 400-meter hurdles in college the first half, until it became painfully obvious that I would not be competing in the Olympics. I just did not have anywhere close to that level of talent.
Yeah.
But I always knew what I would have wanted in my agent had I been good enough. And so when I left the OJ, I did the unthinkable and hung out my own shingle representing athletes. And my first athlete was a European cyclist, and then a second and a third, then some marathoners in track and field. And I jokingly say that I expanded to the United States, meaning I started with European-based athletes and clients, then eventually went to the NFL and some NBA talent, and then a pretty deep portfolio of summer and winter Olympians. Now, part of what that involved was what we called a 360 management deal, which means in the 360 degree scope of our representation, the first component, at least as far as I was concerned, was communications. Because mind you, my early clients were largely unknown, at least by conventional American audiences. These were cyclists and runners and what have you. And so I had to develop a story, a narrative, a texture to give them not only visibility, but desirability, right? If the end objective was to make them a viable investment vehicle from a sponsorship standpoint, nobody's going to support, much less invest in, somebody they never heard of. So communications was incredibly important for that, but it really didn't stop there. It only expanded the larger our client base got. Well, about 10 years ago, Major, I got to a point where it was at the end of the year and I was kind of just looking over the books. And I realized in the course of that 360 management, that means we did all the PR, we did all of their legal work, all of their contract negotiations, all of their sponsorship and endorsements, all of their philanthropy, everything but their bookkeeping. In the process of that representation and in developing the communications aspect, I had consistently, year over year, been building a broader and broader book of business to the point where I was consistently securing blue chip media, right? The likes of which individuals or corporations would kill for, or at a minimum, pay top dollar for, to be blunt. Mm-hmm. Now we're talking about the likes of the Wall Street Journal, USA Today, Us Weekly, People Magazine, CNN, ESPN, Fox News, and the list goes on. But that was so critically important in the context of those early athletes. Mm-hmm. And not to say it wasn't with the larger of the NFL personalities, the starting center and the Giants and stuff like that, But it got to a point where I realized I needed to bifurcate this. So I created a second company, and this is what brings your question full circle. I created Achilles PR with the underlying notion that the inherent weakness or the proverbial Achilles heel of an athlete or a personality or a brand is the ability to tell their own story. And if you can't tell your own story, if you don't have a cohesive, concise, effective communications plan, you'll never stand up, much less stand out from an increasingly crowded marketplace.
Yeah,
so that's where I've been for the better part of the last almost 18 years.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, you mentioned your professional training as a lawyer. How do you think that informed and educated your ability to be a public relations specialist?
Well, deliberate communication, right? You're conscious of every word you do and don't use. I'm also a stickler for punctuation, but there's not a day that's not involved in my professional life in some form or fashion, from redlining a contract to writing opening statements, talking points, speeches, you name it.
Yeah.
I do an incredible amount of writing, and before that, people see the talking, the speaking, but what precedes that is the writing, and what precedes that, if you're going to unpack the equation in reverse order, is the reading.
Yeah.
And all of that started in law school, and you had to be not only an effective writer, not these expansive essays, but strategic, persuasive, rule and fact-based persuasion to get the end result that you're looking for. So all of that informed communication strategy. We still, to this day, write using the CRAC method. It's an acronym, meaning conclusion, binding rule, the analysis, the application of that rule, and then put a period on the sentence, restate the conclusion. There's nothing worse in an interview than when somebody just kind of trails off and says, so that's pretty much it. Bookend it. So that's exactly how the law side of things informs my day-to-day work on the comms side.
Very well done. Very well done. Talk to me about the differences that you see from public affairs and public relations.
Sure. Well, PR and PA, I think, are, it might sound hokey to say it, but I feel like they're almost kissing cousins, meaning there's such similarity there. It's not a hand-over-hand overlap in terms of identical, but there is so much overlap in the two, and not redundancy. I see it less as competition and more as complement. And by that I say, on the PA side and the PR side, the real delineation is in the endpoint. It's downrange at the target, right? On the PA side, it's largely governmental based, right? On the PR side, it's largely commercial based. Now, everything leading up to that endpoint downrange is incredibly similar, from the organizational structure, from the commitment to the basics and foundational efficacy, to the principles of strategic development, to the discipline of tactical execution, also the adaptability, because environmental conditions change constantly. But the importance of having that tight PR plan, that disciplined execution, but also the adaptability to change with evolving circumstances. Look, I don't have to tell you, when one army invades another country, what are the first two things they do? They destroy the airfields, and destroy the communications towers, right? Because you want to limit defense or evacuation, and you want to cripple communication. And that is time immemorial. And that, in so many ways, underscores the importance of communications, whether on a literal battlefield or the commercial battlefield that we're seeing take place across corporate America, where million-dollar brands have ascended to billion-dollar status, and that's becoming an increasingly crowded marketplace. So whether it's share price, whether it's consumer confidence, whether it's just marketplace competition, having a clean, cohesive communication strategy is critically important.
Absolutely. Well, what kind of clients do you typically service? Are they civilians, or are they, I'd say, independent people, or are they companies? And what do you do for them on a daily basis?
Well, I'm so proud, you know, over the last decade plus, really going even deeper than that, you know, if you start with the sports side, I've really worked hard to develop a diverse portfolio of clients. I never, you know, when I started on the sports side, I never just wanted to be a track guy or a football guy. I always wanted to, I envisioned it like a toolbox. You know, you open your toolbox for a project, you have your hammer, your saw, your screwdriver, your wrench, your pliers, etc. And the totality of which is what makes the toolbox effective, meaning whatever the task is, you have the piece to solve the puzzle, and sometimes they all work together. Well, that's really proven true insofar as developing a client portfolio. Yeah, we've had a deep, and I'm proud to still maintain a rather diverse athlete portfolio. But when we launched the sister company, Achilles PR, I couldn't be the face of Achilles like I was for DLE, where it would just seem like DLE 2.0. And so we threaded the comms from the sports side through Achilles, but we also wanted it to be a truly commercial outward-facing PR firm. So in the scope of that, I've had the privilege to work with a variety of clients, from political candidates to obviously the aforementioned athletes,
right,
to veteran startups like Horse Soldier Bourbon. I bet a lot of people in the audience would be familiar with that name. Horse Soldier Bourbon was founded by the 12 Green Berets that entered Afghanistan on horseback in the days following 9/11. Now remember, at the time, now first of all, the Horse Soldier moniker came from then SecDef Rumsfeld, when an errant folder was slid out of a manila folder and a crafty reporter caught it, and he was later pressed on it and acknowledged our horse soldiers over there. They initially wanted to put him in via helicopter, but the height and air of the Hindu Kush, it seemed problematic. So they inserted these 12 Green Berets and their alphabet attachment on horseback. At the time, the U.S. military hadn't trained on horses since World War II. So the story is so incredible that Hollywood made a movie about it. Thor, Chris Hemsworth, was the lead in it. And now, to this day, the horse soldier statue stands at Ground Zero. It's the only statue in the former location of the World Trade Center, you know, aside from obviously the monument. The saddles that they rode are on display in the 9/11 Museum, and their bottles are pressed from steel recovered from Ground Zero. They're no longer a client, so this isn't an ad or a plug, but I use them as a jumping off point to show or to demonstrate the depth of clients that we've worked with, from Horse Soldier Bourbon to the Honor Foundation to VSRG. These are all military released, or VSOs, or veteran entrepreneur startups, to a political candidate that we just worked with, Eddie Garcia, ran in the GOP primary in Virginia. Eddie was a 22-year veteran, 14 combat with Spec Ops, 6 combat deployments.
Wow.
I'm proud. The reason I started by saying I feel at home here, because of my military connection, that's something I mean. And that's something that I take very seriously. So any opportunity that I have to work with military facing, be it active duty or that transition to civilian life, I jump at the chance. But then, of course, there have been really kind of a crazy bucket of clients that I didn't necessarily see coming, from Real Housewives to Ann Pizza Brand, which we've launched across the D.C. region. Now they have dozens of locations and the like. But again, the objective was always to be diverse, because I think that cross-pollination of relationships and skill sets that you have to use in one environment or industry only increases your abilities in the other. That's why swimmers, when they're growing up, they train every stroke, not just focusing on one. That becomes self-evident later, but they train every stroke because the strength in each improves the other.
What do you provide clients typically, and have you ever had any sort of one-off or unusual support requirements for them?
A lot of unusual requests. Not all of them are appropriate for a program. But when we talk about the suite of services or that toolbox, we talk about media training. We talk about media placement. We talk about, so that's outward going, but also incoming media management, being the mouthpiece, the voice for the client. And then, of course, there are things like I mentioned, Horse Soldier Bourbon, just as a point of reference. We do brand management. We do brand strategy and engagement, right? We also do crisis comms, event management, and then, of course, all the commercial partnerships or sponsorships or things like that.
Yeah.
So there's really a broad suite of services. But I've always approached it much like a suit. You can buy it and have it altered and taken in. But if you really want your program to fit the needs of your client, you have to measure the client and build it outward from there.
Mm.
Not take a kit off the box and make tweaks and tailors and say, this will more or less fit. And so I'm always very deliberate with clients that we bring on, because I want it to be a good fit, because I want the results and the outcome to justify our place and our position, because ultimately, like so many industries, but most assuredly in public relations, it's your reputation, your relationships, and your results. And I'm incredibly proud of all three.
Right. You want to tailor your services to the client. You want to make sure the client is good for you as sort of the PR representative for them. Okay, great. You know, crisis communication seems to be a big part of any public relations or public affairs specialist's job. And I imagine it's part of yours as well. I saw some of the examples on your website. So can you tell me how you approach crisis comms?
It's really twofold. It's the commitment and disciplined planning that goes into it. And then it is the dutiful execution of that plan when the moment arises. When you talk about the similarities between PR and PA, I'm sure a lot of the viewers are fans of Game of Thrones. I certainly am a total Game of Thrones nerd, and I love the spinoff show House of Dragons. Well, without giving any spoilers, in the last episode, this tragic event happened in the previous episode, and this one picks up in the hours following. And there's this character, Otto Hightower. He's the Hand of the King, which is like the de facto chief of staff, senior advisor. But in this moment, he takes on the absolute role of a public affairs officer, because he leans into the king when the king is going histrionic with grief and anger and just utter disbelief at what had happened. And he said, "Sire, we're on the precipice of war. Both of our standing armies will most assuredly be decimated. Our dragons, as well as our foes, will probably all die. But most importantly, the small folk, as they call the average citizen, will probably die in the process, and the world as we know it will never be the same, assuming it stands at all when we're done. If we use this terrible moment and message it, determine how we want to communicate to the masses, we can line up our bannermen and either prevent this war before it starts, or if war is inevitable, we can create a swift and hopefully minimize casualties at the conclusion." And I smile at that because I think, you know, that's such a contemporaneous, albeit slightly obfuscated, example of the role of public affairs and public relations. It's understanding, and this goes back to your question about crisis communications, because there was a absolute extreme crisis within the program. And somebody had to, in the moment, say, we need to galvanize this moment. We need to act with a cool head. This is not the time to strike back. Now, in the real world, we don't always have that benefit, right? And the way that I approach crisis communications is to develop a plan up front. And much like I talked about tailoring to the needs of the individual client, what you have to do is effectively a SWOT analysis, strengths, weaknesses, you know, and the like. And with that, determine what are the core strengths of your client, what are the target weaknesses, what would competitors or market forces, how would it impact your client, right? And then you have to effectively develop communication tourniquets. How are you going to stop the bleeding if this happens? How can we effectively create that communications triage to mitigate the damage, to ensure the wholeness of our client, to terminate the threat as best we can from a communication standpoint, and to create stability? Now, you can't predict what direction it's coming from or when, but that's where I say it's the duality of both dutiful planning and disciplined execution. My son just finished kindergarten, and every other month they do a fire drill. Yeah. And the whole point of that fire drill is, when you have little kids, if they hear the bell and they think there's a fire, they're going to create panic. Mm-hmm. And the whole point of the fire drill is to create calm when the inevitable happens. So they all line up in a row. You know who's in front of you. You know who's behind you. You calmly follow the predetermined exit. So if a fire ever comes, there's no panic and everybody's safe. Mm-hmm. By way of a watered down analogy, in so many ways, that is the importance of the communications plan. You put it in place before smoke, before fire, so that when it does happen, you're prepared. Remember, Noah built the ark before the first raindrop fell.
That's right. Well, we've got a question from social media. Steffo asks, what's the biggest upcoming challenge that PR professionals will need to adapt to in the next few years, and how do you stay ahead of the curve?
Well, Steffo, that's a fantastic question. And the reality is probably twofold. Number one is the continued rollout of social media, right? We've seen in the last 10 years the critical role that social media plays, not only in a proactive outward-facing communication strategy, but also in responsive real-time, whether it's fact-checking, right? Whether it's the rapid response room during political campaigns, you'll certainly see a taste of that tomorrow night, you know, during and following the first presidential debate.
Yeah.
So understanding the role and utility of social media, but also we're going to see an increase in pressure surrounding misinformation and disinformation. And I love this question, Steffo, because historically we would have think of misinformation and disinformation as somewhat narrow definitions. But the reality is, in recent years, the application and definition of those terms is getting increasingly murky. Who determines what's true, right? And is it as binary as true or false, fact or fiction? And where is that clutch and acceleration point between the two when you're shifting gears? Mm-hmm. And so I think communications is going to be the delineator and in so many ways the decider in shaping public opinion, public discourse, and the public call to action.
Yeah, absolutely. Talk to me about some of the examples of instances where you've been able to help a client get through a crisis that ultimately led to positive effects for that client.
You know, the one that always comes to mind is one that holds a special place in my heart. Following the 2014 Winter Olympics, we had Nick Farrell, an Olympic ski jumper. And if you've never seen Olympic ski jumping, it's incredible. That's where they come down the slope, they hit the ramp. They're coming out, but you know, parallel to the mountain, they're at a 45 degree angle, you know, leaning forward over the skis. It's incredible to watch. Now, it might seem like a minor sport here in the US, but in Europe, like so many others, it's massive, especially obviously during the winter alpine season. And Nick it was the year following the Winter Olympics. So there's always just like with the Tour de France and the months following the tour, the riders can make a lot of money doing charity rides and stuff like that. Well, the year following the Olympics, athletes, we call it the comet tail, can make a lot of money doing appearances and lesser competitions because of their Olympic appearance. So Nick was over in Europe for a huge meet. What a lot of people don't realize is that the jump starts way up the mountain and you come down, you hit a full head of speed before you hit the end of the ramp. They have wind gauges and everything else to determine is it good to jump, not jump, etc. Long story short, Nick hit the end of the ramp and misjudged his landing. He had a ski cross and instead of coming down tail to nose on his skis, he went heel over nose and rolled, and it was a terrible crash. And the immediate, because of the severity of the crash, it wasn't clear whether Nick survived. Now, mind you, this is being broadcast on European television. It is a massive event. There's over 100,000 people on the side of the mountain. It is a major sporting endeavor. And it was so bad they didn't know whether he was alive. So the medical units are racing onto the scene. There's literally a hushed tone over the crowd. It's all these drunken Europeans, you know, with the cowbells and the Viking horns. And it was silent.
Wow.
Everybody on the mountain appreciated the severity of the moment. And I say that to set the stage for what followed. Because in those moments, nobody knew if Nick was alive. They put him on the backboard. And as they were putting him into the ambulance to get him off the mountain, and I'll never forget, it's one of those Life magazine cover, you know, moments.
Mm-hmm.
Nick literally raised up a little American flag, and it was blowing in the wind.
Wow.
Hollywood couldn't recreate it with the effect that it had in that moment. But here's where the crisis communications really took traction. I was already on the phone. I'm on the phone with Team USA. I'm trying to connect with Nick's family. There's a sense of panic and confusion across the board. It's the communications fog of war. But it's in those moments of confusion that someone with a steady hand and a sense of clarity can help guide the ship, can help navigate the literal and figurative icebergs, as it were. So my job in that moment, Major, wasn't about planting a story or being the buttoned-up spokesman. It was about preventing the story. It was about digging a moat, raising the drawbridge, and insulating my client from the concerned media. Now remember, European media and American media are very different in a variety of ways, but the Europeans at a minimum are very persistent. And so in these moments, now the severity of Nick's injuries quickly started to unfold in the hours that followed. He had multiple punctured vital organs, he had a collapsed lung, he had choking on his own blood, snapped vertebra, etc. So it was severe to say the least, but he was immovable. So while we're trying to negotiate logistics to get his family over, trying to figure out a government plane to get him moved, trying to figure out the appropriate lodging, I am with a whip and a chair keeping media at bay, because the last thing that we want is, again, what I referenced with Steffo's question, which was misinformation, disinformation. And Churchill famously said, a lie gets halfway around the world before the truth gets its pants on in the morning. So the last thing that I wanted to be doing was correcting the record when the media already ran with it, because the cover story goes on page one, the retraction or correction goes on page 27. And so I burned some matches and maybe some bridges during that process, but I was able for that week plus to keep the media completely at bay until we hand selected an outlet and gave the, you know, released the details and gave a very filtered, edited interview for them. But it's in those moments, I jokingly say that sometimes the best PR that I've ever done are the stories you haven't heard.
Yeah.
And that's just perhaps one example.
Okay, great. Thank you for that. We've got another question from social media. Josh Fry asks, How do the constraints we face in the military or government communications compare to those in the civilian sector? So again, you know, in the private sector, you have a bit more latitude and capability to kind of utilize things like budget and other things like that to you know, communicate and whatnot. So how do you kind of balance those and compare that to the restrictions that are placed on us in the government sector?
Well, again, I think Josh raised a great question, just like Steph-O did. And I'll tell you, the infrastructure and the org chart that you enjoy in the military is something that there is a commonality in the civilian sector. And if you ultimately do transition from service to civilian side, let me tell you, you're going to have a tremendous competitive advantage. And let me be clear as to why I say that. Number one, you understand chain of command. Number two, you understand siloed responsibility and absolute accountability. Number three, you understand that there is no I in team, right? You work together because, you know, in this industry, your name is on the front, not on the back of the jersey. It's on the front of the uniform. It's the flag on the shoulder that unites all of you. And so it's that common sense of purpose and teamwork. Now, in terms of the actual restrictions, as it might be, the civilian side has a chain of command as well. And I think sometimes where people run afoul of that is when they become the cowboy. You have to understand it starts with the mission statement. It starts with, well, within your organization, what are the corporate values? What is the corporate mission statement? What is the philosophy of engagement? What are the rules of engagement, right? Because you're not just ultimately representing the client. That's not your logo on the business card. Maybe I'm an exception, but generally speaking, it's not your logo. You're working for your corporation or your firm or what have you. And especially when you start getting into larger corporations or publicly traded entities, there is a litany of communication restrictions in terms of what can be said, what can't be said, how it has to be messaged. We work with pharmaceutical companies as it relates to our athletes and the sponsorship and the social media restrictions on that because of the federal regulations governing pharmaceuticals and what is deemed advertising or not advertising. You lose a job and the company loses share value. So you're out the door pretty quickly, like the old Flintstones cartoon, the introduction. Mm-hmm. So I don't think that the military is necessarily constrictive in terms of its org chart and its order of operations and its protocol. I think if anything, Josh, it's really setting you up to be even more successful as you ultimately transition to the civilian side, because you will have that inherent discipline and sense of order that you'll really be able to employ to your advantage. So you're getting a great starting point here.
And Josh had a follow-up question basically asking, how do you see that, you know, the techniques and tools used in the civilian sector PR can help the military overcome our challenges and things like recruiting and retention specifically?
Well, I think first of all, great follow-up. You guys are killing it with the questions. But look, I think the reality is we all need a fresh set of eyes on things. All of us, right? That's irrespective of industry or the individual. So when it comes to bringing in civilian insight or sentiment, that's critically important, especially if they're being drawn, just to seize on the recruitment example, if they're being drawn from the target recruitment base, then you need to leave the castle walls to understand, again, the Game of Thrones, what the small folk are saying and feeling and doing or not doing, right? If ultimately this is not complied or compelled service, but rather requested service, then you have to create the carrot if you don't have the benefit of the stick. You have to get them to want to do it. So it's understanding human sentiment. That's why we talk about demographics and psychographics, and those aren't the same thing. So I do think there's a real value add with military transitioning to civilian sector because of all the value and benefit and structure and expertise that they bring. I do think it strengthens the team to have civilian input and insight as the military is continuing to evolve and adapt and expand its equation.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I tell you, you know, in the schoolhouse, anyways, much of what we teach is informed by what's being done in the private sector. Many of the kind of ideas and rules and concepts are informed by what is being done in the private sector. So I think there's definitely some overlap and transition there. So if you're doing this in the military currently, transitioning into the civilian sector shouldn't be that big of a jump. Oh. So besides crisis communication, what are some other tools, other capabilities that you bring to the table that you provide for your clients on a regular basis?
Well, every client is different, right? And again, there is no such thing, at least as far as I'm concerned, as PR in a box. You have to develop and tailor your suite of services to the needs of the client, not just where they want to be, but every journey is relative to the starting point. And you have to meet them where they are, adapt your plan in order to help get them where they want to be. So what does that actually entail? We offer a suite of services from media training and preparation to media placement, to media management, to obviously crisis communications, to brand development and brand marketing, to political consulting. Now, I'm not a lobbyist, so I'm not conflating those two, but we work with campaigns, writing speeches, writing talking points, conducting oppo research, doing debate preparation, which is critically important. Mm-hmm. Now, thematically, what am I talking about, guys? There are three things that are woven through all of this: reading, writing, speaking, and they're inextricably connected. Right? And so when I talk about these different services, though, as well as event management, brand adaptation and sponsorship, portfolio development, et cetera, at least on the commercial side, and then just straight publicity. There are some people that don't say it's not as simplistic as I want to be famous, but I want to raise my profile, because if I can do that, then it's going to open more commercial opportunities for this sector. So it's getting the invite to this event or the red carpet for that, or a seat at the table for this benefit, et cetera. And again, that might seem like scattershot or buckshot, but not every client is a 30-odd six down range with a tight scope, right? Mm-hmm. You have to understand that you have a suite of services and you have to tailor it to the needs of the client. So yeah. No two clients is the same. And that means that my job is never boring.
Right.
Every day is long, but no two days are the same.
Sure. I'm glad you didn't say arithmetic, by the way. We got another question from social media, from Don Nelson. Can you talk about how private sector PR firms evaluate writing skills in light of ChatGPT and other AI tools? So AI, yeah, it's the big story of the day, huh?
Yeah, first of all, when I heard Don Nelson, I thought the famous NBA coach. It's incredible. I wouldn't be surprised if he's watching. Your audience is pretty diverse. AI is it's an enigma. It's inevitable. The question isn't whether it's going to be here, it's already here.
Yeah.
The question is what's going to be the impact and the severity of the asteroid when it hits.
Sure.
Now, AI is by definition, right? Artificial intelligence is artificial. It's designed to estimate, evaluate, and not to sound fatal, but eviscerate, right? It's designed to be more efficient than people because it can estimate the course of outcomes. It can, in every iteration, it can, you know, when Deep Blue, IBM developed the chess program and it was playing the grand chess champions, it had millions of moves in its head as well as counter moves. And so it was deemed unbeatable until maybe it was, right? In the context of AI's integration with public relations and ChatGPT, I can always tell when somebody I know sends me a ChatGPT generated email. I'm like, come on, Jack, this isn't your pentameter, this isn't your intonation, this isn't your punctuation. And the problem with that, especially if it's persuasive writing in the public relations sense, is that it loses the emotive human element.
Mm.
And that's the one thing. Look, we've all seen the stories and defense news and everything else about the adaptive AI programs that they're contemplating putting in fighter jets, and how even the Top Gun pipeline isn't able to keep pace with the AI programs and the jets, and that raises a lot of question marks and concerns.
Sure.
But that's more binary.
Right.
That fails to capture the human persuasive element that we talk about in communications, right?
Yeah.
The not to seem cliche, but the heartstrings, understanding human emotion, right? I'm not talking about the beating of the heart. AI can map that. I'm talking about what tugs at their heart.
Yeah.
So understanding how to persuasively write in a way that moves people, right? Either moves them to get out of the way or moves them to stand in line shoulder to shoulder and hold the rank.
Mm-hmm.
That is something that AI has yet to penetrate. And I don't know how long those sandbags are going to hold.
Yeah.
But understanding human texture, our suede as people, what makes us human, that isn't something that humans have got or that AI has gotten to at this point. So it's critically important that we continue to hone our craft, because anybody can get stale, right, and be usurped in the process.
Sure. No, absolutely. Talk to me about some of the biggest challenges that you face as a PR professional, and ultimately, how do you overcome them?
You know, I'm so fortunate. I enjoy what I do. You know, I enjoy the clients that I work with. To me, the biggest challenge in public relations is probably the same as public affairs as well. And it's dealing with personalities. Because ultimately what you're doing, and it's not about the plan you implement or the discipline with which you execute that plan or your ultimate adaptability and jazz, your ability to evolve and go with the moment.
Yeah.
The challenging element or aspect is always managing personalities. Not only is that the largest time drain, but also it can be the most emotional drain, right? Yeah. I'm not talking about competition. We used to call them candle blowers, right? Mm-hmm. Somebody that will blow your candle out to make theirs shine brighter.
Sure.
People can always talk trash or say bad things about you because ultimately it's your reputation, your relationships, and your results. As I mentioned earlier, I like alliteration. Remember those three R's, guys. But your results are what speak for themselves, right? And so you have to rise above and don't get drawn into the everyday scuttlebutt, especially as things get exacerbated on social media, just like I referenced that Churchill quote. Focus on those three R's. Focus on your reputation. Now, guys, I'm not talking about your brand. I'm talking about your reputation, what people say and think about you when you're not in the room, okay? Develop your relationships. When you're active duty, that's critically important. Your relationship, your reputation will determine your ascension up the ladder in terms of rank progression. Your relationships will help that process, but they'll also be critically important if and when you ultimately transition to the civilian sector. And look at your results. Look at the resume and the portfolio that you can point to because results top and topple everything. It doesn't matter what people say about you if you have the results that back up the integrity of your work. Because just like the legendary NFL owner Al Davis famously once said, just win, baby. And what he meant was winning tops everything. And if you can put together a fantastic resume, your results, that'll really spur you forward.
Yeah, risk is actually something that we have to manage and mitigate in the military as well. And what we teach our students when we're talking about operations in the informational environment is risk to force, right? The service members, risk to mission, right? The ability to actually get the mission done, and then risk to brand, right? Risk to brand is something we also think about and worry about and, you know, always are trying to be considerate of when we're communicating to the many different stakeholders and publics that are relevant to our mission. But we have another question from social media. This is from Keller Army Community Hospital. Have you ever had a client who disagreed with your PR crisis comms course of action, and how did you address it?
Yeah, that's a great question. And yeah, of course that's happened. Look, you are brought in the room to tell them they're wrong, right? In simplest form, and let me unpack that because I know that seems counterintuitive. But you hire an outside advisor, especially somebody that's going to be in charge of how the rest of the world perceives you, right? That's ultimately what public relations is. You could also supplement it with public perception, right? The relationship you have with the public is determined in large part by the perception that the public has of you. And clients generally have a strong idea of how they want to be perceived and therefore received, right? But if they knew it in concrete, much less how to execute it, you probably wouldn't be in the room in the first place. So one thing I often tell clients is, look, I'm here to tell you no, and I'm here to tell you you're wrong. Not to be argumentative or disagreeable, but it's easy to say yes, right? Let's weed out the bad ideas. Let's narrow down the good ideas. Let's execute, and let's be ruthless, because those results will speak for themselves. But you also have to understand, and this is what goes back to the previous question regarding the difference in dichotomy between, you know, service and civilian life. There's also a chain of command. Now, it might be slightly flatter on the commercial PR side, but the reality is this. The CEO is always the client. So when you're in the room, it's your job to express your opinion. You know, and I referenced the crack format of writing to reference your conclusion, to buttress it with the rules and the concrete example, to provide the analysis of why you feel that way, to convince them in the room, because once they leave the room, the die is cast. But ultimately, they are the CO, and it's their orders that run, and you're beholden to the client. There is a chain of command, whether service or civilian side. Don't get it twisted. That is absolutely always going to be the case, and so it's my job to convince them. But I wouldn't be good at my job if I couldn't convince the client, right? If you want us to convince the public, it starts in the room, but ultimately the client rules.
Yeah, that sounds a lot like what we try and do as public affairs professionals, is ultimately we're that advisor to the commander. It's ultimately up to the commander, the decision they make and the risk they want to take. And that's what being a commander is all about, is accepting and mitigating risk. So we've got a lot of great questions today from our audience. I want to thank you so much for all the wonderful questions you've provided. But I actually got a few questions from our staff back at the schoolhouse I want to throw at you, since you seem very well-versed in being able to handle pretty much anything that can be thrown your way. So let's see how you handle these. Let's talk about negative comments on social media. How, as a public relations specialist, would you tell a client to engage with negative social media interactions, or would you tell them to engage? Obviously, you know, you've got trolls, you've got bad actors out there who are trying to attack the client. What do you tell them in those specific situations?
Well, it's case specific, and I'll give you two examples. Number one, if it's an individual, you know, Joe Rogan has a consistent joke, you know, never read the comments. Dave Chappelle doubles down on that too, never read the comments. And there's some truth to that, but the reality is this, and I'm gonna draw a distinction here. If you are an individual, say a professional athlete or a political candidate or what have you, there's not only foreign troll farms that have either utilized semi-fluent English speakers to write or algorithms to generate negative comments, right? Yeah. Because the way that the social media algorithms work, the more comments, the more attention, the more it gets promoted. And so there is an incentive or disincentive, depending on your perspective, to attach as many negative comments as possible to maximize the visibility. Because when people look at a post, they start scrolling down to comments. So there's almost a disincentive as an individual, like a famous individual, a public figure, to engage in negative comments, because it just feeds the animal. Remember, if you want to put out a fire, right, you starve the fire, you take the oxygen out of it. You don't mm-hmm. feed it or the fire gets bigger. So there is a certain level of discipline and restraint that's required for moderation for individuals. But that's very different when it comes to corporations. We saw play out on dramatic scale what happened to Bud Light. They made a series of decisions in terms of their influencer and their marketing program, and pulled in Dylan Mulvaney, who's become a household, if not at least a readily Googleable name, and Budweiser and Bud Light and AnBev, the larger holding company, lost billions with a B of dollars. Now, Bud Light tiptoed around a response, I'm not saying an apology, but a response to the backlash and the pushback of their decisions from a marketing standpoint. And because they didn't answer it, because they allowed that plane to get so far down the runway, mm-hmm. that the damage to the share price was done at that point. So while on one hand, I would say if you're an NFL athlete, don't respond to messages on your Instagram at 2 a.m. Nothing good's mm-hmm. going to come of that. Yeah. If you are an outward-facing, much less publicly traded brand, and there is public backlash or pushback or just even negative sentiment that's starting to gain traction, you have an obligation at a minimum to your shareholders to tactically, in real time, address those comments. So that's a great question from the team, and there is a distinction. And just like I've talked about, again, there's thematic repetition mm-hmm. here. There is no one-size-fits-all with a PR plan, and that most assuredly extends to social media.
Absolutely. And, you know, one of the concepts that we teach whenever we're developing communication plans is the RPI process, right, which is research, planning, implementation, and evaluation. So how do you determine evaluation of any given communication plan that you've originated for your clients? How do you determine whether or not it's been successful? What metrics do you utilize for that?
Well, one of the most important things, you know, when we onboard new clients, is especially those in the commercial space, right, is that I have to remind them I'm not on your sales team. So if you're expecting this to generate sales, there's a certain point where my obligation and my responsibility in the relationship ends. And I often equate it to an alley-oop in basketball, right? Think of Kobe and Shaq, for those of you that are basketball nerds like me. Kobe'd rip down the rebound on the defensive side of the ball, dribble all the way through traffic, find Shaq, and put it up in a place only where Shaquille O'Neal could grab it, and Shaq attack would rip off the rim, right? In so many ways, the public relations officer is the Kobe in that example. It's your obligation to get the ball, which is the target message, navigate through an increasingly crowded court, an increasingly crowded marketplace, mm-hmm. and put your client in a position where they can succeed, meaning put the ball right in front of the rim for them to convert it. Now, where so many people get confused and become dissatisfied is, well, I haven't seen an uptick in sales. You didn't hire me to shoot the three. You hired me to put the ball where you could convert it. Mm-hmm. So I'm giving you leveraged visibility in a persuasive environment, right? With the ramp up and the dovetail on the backside, it's your job to convert it to the sales quotient. Mm-hmm. So there's always education involved with that. But again, it has to be that cohesive relationship, and that's why the fit is so important to begin with.
Yeah, absolutely. So one thing that differentiates public affairs and public relations in many instances is budget, right? So for instance, and typically when you're talking about what we do and communicating to the public, there's the POEM model, right? Paid, owned, and earned media are probably a constant between the two entities. But the area where we don't usually delve into is the paid aspect. As public relations, I imagine you have a bit more flexibility there in the payment aspect. So how do you determine what kind of budget would go into trying to affect change or knowledge of a specific thing or a message you're trying to get across? How do you determine that budget?
Well, look, I think the most, you know, within the acronym, I think the most effective, and I've seen this play out for 20 years and the trend line isn't changing, the most effective element is the earned media because it's the most authentic, right? People don't watch everything live anymore. They'll TiVo through commercials, or they'll hit mute or hit change the channel. They flip the page in a magazine and turn past the ads. So traditional paid media is largely ineffective, right? Most of the paid media we see now is when the client budgets for paid social media promotion, right? Boosting our strategic social media, and that's something that I can't believe I've glossed over thus far. Social media is a tactical and strategic. Social media is a huge part of what we do on behalf of the client, writing in their voice, producing in their voice, placing in their voice, understanding the persuasion and the real-time response or non-response as the situation may merit. Yeah. But really the application for paid media, as far as I'm concerned, is in social promotion. The paid media model is struggling. Yeah. Earned media, in my experience, is the most valuable because it's the most authentic. Mm. And ultimately, authenticity is what changes minds and hearts, period. Mm. Having that authentic, real human connection with somebody else, that's when they listen, that's when they lean forward, that's when they remember, and ultimately, if truly effective, that's when they act. Yeah. And that's the leveraged earned media that we focus on so heavily.
Okay, great. Well, it's come to the end of our program. And before we say goodbye to you, we always want to ask, is there anything else you'd like to add?
You know, again, I want to thank you for having me here. This really, it was an honor to be here for all of the reasons that I've mentioned and so many others that I don't have time for. If there's one thing that I would add, it's number one, remember the three R's, guys, because as antiquated as it may seem, they're timeless, right? Read, write, speak, right? Read, write, speak, because those are the foundation for everything that you're going to do on a communication standpoint. The more you read, the better you write. The better you write, the better you speak. The better you speak, the more you're going to want to read to reinforce that. And then secondly, I love working with students of all levels and ages. We do an internship and a clerkship program in the summertime, and I'm proud of all the relationships that we've built with transitioning service members, the brave men and women in uniform that serve on behalf of our country. You can find me easily, but from basic Google or on social media, it's just at Doug Eldridge. Send me an email, send me a text, send me a DM. I'm happy to answer any questions, point you in the right direction, or at a minimum, stay in touch. So I hope you'll take me up on that.
All right. Awesome. Well, thank you again so much for taking time out to be here on the program. We really appreciate it. And that's our show for this month. And of course, I want to thank our guest for stopping by and sharing his knowledge and expertise. And I'd also like to thank you all for taking time out to watch our program and ask some really great questions. So we really appreciate that. And remember, if you would prefer to listen to this show rather than watch it, know that DINFOS Live is also a podcast. And you can actually find it on your podcatcher of choice. Just search for DINFOS Live. Make sure to join us next month on July 31st at 2 p.m. Eastern when we'll have another amazing guest who will be talking about various topics related to the world of public affairs. Well, for everyone at DINFOS and the Defense Media Activity, I'm Major David J. Murphy, and we'll see you all next month. Bye, everybody.